I opened the House Committee on Human Services today, March 6, 2009, and opened up the public hearing on House Bill 2123. Keely?
This bill directs the Department of Human Services to report to each regular session of the legislature on staff workload, workload efficiency, and staffing needs in the areas of child welfare, temporary assistance for needy families, nutritional assistance, and vocational rehabilitation services. And I don't think we have the amendments back on this yet, but amendments have been submitted to also add the areas of medical assistance and assistance to seniors and disabled persons to the reporting areas.
Great. So we have somebody from the department wanting to tell us about this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and appreciate the chance to talk to you about House Bill 2123 today. It, as has been explained to you, it's a fairly simple bill. It requires a department to report to each regular session of the legislature in terms of workload increases or decreases in child welfare, self-sufficiency, and vocational rehabilitation programs. And additionally, it requires the department to collaborate with its existing advisory groups to implement workload efficiencies that have been found in the meantime. Over the past 6 years, the department has been working as a result of a legislative budget note to move from a caseload-based staffing model to a workload-based model. And the major difference is there that instead of a fixed number of cases per worker, it really takes a look at what does it take to do the work and then derive the number of workers needed based on that much more accurate measure. We've done three studies over the past three biennia. The first two in self-sufficiency and seniors and vocational rehabilitation programs, the third one released last year in child welfare. At the same time, the department has been doing a fair amount of work also with legislative funding assistance in transforming their work and making sure that the work that we do is as efficient as it can be. And so the department hired McKinsey and Company as consultants to help us identify some of the opportunities that exist there. And now each division is going through their list of opportunities and implementing workload efficiencies where they can find them. With Children, Adults, and Families Division, most of those opportunities are in the operational sector, so it has a direct impact on the workload and, in fact, looks at reducing the work. So House Bill 2123 recognizes that, I think, important intersection of transformation and efficiency and a better measure of what the workload is, and requires the department to report every session what the current workload is and how we've done in implementing the efficiencies that have been designed to give the legislature, I think, a better picture of what the net workload needs of the department are in making decisions about that. As you've also been told, we've also requested an amendment that would add the senior and persons with disabilities division to this, so they would be part of the report as well. The department doesn't believe there's any fiscal impact along with this bill, and I'd be happy to answer questions that you have.
Great. Any questions? Representative Olson and then Representative Cowan.
Go ahead. Okay. Thank you. Jim, I'm reading, taking a look at the bill. I'm taking a look at the letter that you provided us, and I want to say thanks for the letter. Why are you needing to do this through a statute?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, this is my 13th session of testifying in front of the legislature. And for most of those sessions, I've been testifying in one form or another about workload needs of the department. And the fact is there's always a tug in terms of workload needs, funding, and number of employees. I think at the direction of the legislature and really because of that tug and concern that people were working with the best information possible, that the department has moved from a caseload to a workload standard, and that's one of the reasons we are looking at transformation to reduce those workload needs. But it seems to me that in order to institutionalize this change, that includes better information as well as a report back to the legislature in terms of the efforts that we've made to reduce the need for additional staff through efficiency improvements is worthy of a report to the legislature. So that's why we've asked.
And if I may add to that, I think that is entirely appropriate that this committee continue every legislative session to hear from the department, to hear about the workload, to hear what they're doing, to hear about the transformation process. I hear more in the Ways and Means Committee, subcommittee for the Department of Human Services than I ever did in my 8 years, and I know Representative Boone, you spent time on the Health and Human Services Committee too. And I think this is important information for us to have, so that we know how the department is doing and also so that we can learn how to support the department. And we'll talk more about what I had suggested during remonstrances about us visiting the department. Hopefully on each of us can do that on our in-service day.
I agree with what you're saying. I do agree that it's very important to be able to hear that information, especially from their perspective and everything. I have a background of policy and rules and regulations, and I question as to whether there's that need for the connection, for sharing that, you know, rules, regulations, and policies through a statute. That's
I can appreciate it. And yeah. You and I, as long as we're on this committee, we would probably want to hear this.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
My concern is that in the future, especially if it goes back to being Health and Human Services, that this may go way down on the list of things that the chair might and vice chairs might see as important to do. But thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming. I understand Representative Olson's concerns, and it's an interesting dilemma as to whether this has to be statutory or not. I do appreciate the effort to look at workload as opposed to caseload. I think that's a difficult thing to communicate more broadly than perhaps the expertise on this committee. And so helping with some understanding of that on a broader level as to what some of our individuals are facing in terms of workload, whatever size caseload it might be, I think it's very important. Particularly, I focus a lot on the seniors and people with disability world and understand how challenging some of those particular interactions can be. My question is, in the scope of what you're doing, while you're primarily facing or focusing on within the State Department's efforts, I think many of us are beginning to talk about the interconnectedness with other levels of government and service delivery and ways in which it's time that we begin to take a serious look at how we're doing things at all levels, that every level of government is struggling right now, and if not now, when will we have this conversation? So I think my question is just around, in the course of this conversation, will you be intending to incorporate some of your local delivery systems, other levels of government, and how we might streamline some of that effort?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. And in in most of my experience with the department, the local delivery system is state-operated, but we have a lot of interaction with the federal government, and we have rather a rich history of dealing with the federal government and requesting waivers as how they require us to do things doesn't seem to make sense, or we think of better ways with that. At the same time, seniors and persons with disabilities has a much different field structure and works more closely with local governments, AAAs, as you well know. And I think they also look at how they can interact better together.
Follow up, Chair. And just to throw in, I guess, maybe make sure I'm understood, I understand that much of your local delivery system is still state-operated or state-funded offices, but we also roll into city and county, particularly delivery systems in the world of mental health and addictions treatment and a variety of things that I think it's important as we look at it that we look at the whole picture of services that we need to deliver and figure out ways that we can deliver them in the most cost-effective manner.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Cowan. Indeed, each division within DHS what I'm talking about is really reporting on workload for, well, what hopefully will be two divisions, but each division has the charge to look at exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about. How do we make the best and most efficient delivery system, whether or not it looks much like it does today?
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And some of my remarks have been made already, but I know that Ways and Means Subcommittee directed the department to do the studies to find out. And I guess I just have to say that that's the kind of action I'd like to see in a lot of our other agencies, because in some cases we're just faced with considering legislation that does this and this and this, and we're not sure how many more people it will require or if they can absorb it in their daily workload. And then when it becomes workload or job, or, you know, DQ or something like another, a different kind of agency. But I appreciate that and think, I don't really have an opinion on the bill being like Representative Olson said, I thought the same thing before you asked the question, but I do think that the idea of looking at how we do business and considering the actual workload, because that's what it is when you're considering the people are doing it, and it's, I think they have to consider, you know, as our demands on services go up or down or flatten out or whatever, it's the workload that matters, and people are people, and they can't be expected to just be like, you know, triple time one day, nothing the next day, and it has to somehow, we have to figure that out, that the best use of the money for that.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Being an old productivity improvement project coordinator for Clackamas County years ago, what this looks like to me is productivity improvement and then a report back to us on the status of caseload, workload, et cetera.
Madam Chair, Representative Orman, that's correct.
Follow up. I think in response to what Representative Olson said, for me, probably putting it in statute at least gives it greater standing, greater strength, and I think in line with what Representative Boone said, I think it's time for us to really be able to communicate to the public what we do with their money. And I think that many of the services provided by the Department of Human Services are not well known. They're assumed, but they're not well known. So the connection between helping people and money, I don't think is clearly understood. So personally, I support this.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Freeman and Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with you that we need the report so we can understand what's going on. And I think I heard you say this, and I apologize if I'm asking a question you've already answered. Did you say there was no extra cost in doing this? And the reason I ask is I think it's important that we be aware of the cost of reporting versus delivering the service. So I don't want to take away the service just for the sake of reporting. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, yes, I said I did not anticipate any fiscal impact from this bill. The fact is we're doing this work already. This is merely a matter of reporting it back to the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Jim. Last week we heard from the wraparound folks talking about the efficiencies of departments working together, and I think predominantly for the sake and benefit of the client. Can you give me a specific example of a promising area where the work has been streamlined to gain efficiencies, just so I can kind of maybe have a visual of what the McKinsey and Company roadmap for transformation has enabled us to do. And also, in that example, the effect on the service and the welfare of the client, our clients, as a part of these efficiencies. What, if you can give me a picture?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, probably a terrific example is in our self-sufficiency services area. As I'm sure you know, I've seen reports in the newspaper about how our self-sufficiency caseloads are growing substantially. I think in February we added 10,300 families to our food stamp rolls, almost over 900 families to our cash assistance rolls. And over time, the department in self-sufficiency has used a model as people come in the door and request services that I equate to a kind of a doctor's office model, that if you need our help, you call and make an appointment and then you come in. And that's worked pretty well over time, but it doesn't respond well when we have the kind of the tremendous need that's out there today. And so what was happening is that our intake schedule was just going out farther and farther because we had time that workers set aside to do the paperwork that they needed to do, and we had X number of intakes scheduled every day, and as those filled up, it just went out farther and farther. McKinsey looked at that and said, you really should try something like what I call a supermarket model, that as the line gets longer, you bring more checkers up to the front. And so that has an impact on the eligibility workers that, all right, they don't get their protected time right then to do their work. But it does get people in the door faster. It does get benefits out faster. And while it's in some cases a difficult change for our workforce to change how they've always done their business, we decided to actually cut short the pilots on that we had started in January and December because they showed so much promise, and we were having such a difficult time keeping up with the workload, and we're seeing dramatic decreases in the time it takes people to come in and get benefits. In most cases, even without additional staff, we're able to reduce what was a 30 to 45 day wait time to same day or next day time.
That is miraculous, isn't it?
Because of a walk-in situation then, rather than an appointment?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, exactly. Now, that still leaves the rest of the work to be done, and as we're training folks on how to approach that and get that done, we're not seeing an increase in the amount of undone paperwork as well, and in fact have picked up some percentage of efficiencies by seeing people the first time they come in, processing them, and not making them come back. And it's made a dramatic difference in our waiting rooms in terms of how many people are there, because they're not there and then come back and come back. And it's actually reduced the number of cases that we've had to pend as people come back later with documentation that they didn't have. They're so excited to be seen the same day that often they come back that same day, drop off the other paperwork that they've needed. So it's not only picked up efficiencies in terms of the workload, it's been, I think, a tremendous improvement in customer service as well.
Awesome.
It really is awesome, and as I was saying, I heard a lot of this in the Ways and Means sub, and I would like to hear more, and what I'd like to do in future hearings is have workers come in and tell us about how that has worked. But also I want to point out, we're putting a greater burden on those workers. We're asking them to change, and you know when you're in a certain way of doing things, you have a system, and now we're asking them to change that system, and that we're also asking them to see a lot more people. So we're asking them to do a lot more in a different way with actually fewer resources. So that was one of the reasons I'm going to be coming back to asking you to visit your own self-sufficiency program in the CAF in your community so that when we, on the in-service day, so that we can get a first-hand view of what these workers really are doing in the field. Yes, Representative.
And to follow on that, I absolutely appreciate making those, say, those process changes, operational changes. But then, you know, about there obviously there's only so much productivity one person can do in an 8-hour day, and so, and then you begin to prioritize what you do, and I think. If you think it's important to deal with them the first time as efficiently as possible, that's great, and you can build efficiency out of seeing them one time instead of two or three. But then at some point you have to go backwards in your processes and say, what's not important? What are we doing that we really don't need to be doing? And I suspect there are a lot of things that we do that aren't really necessary. And I would have, whether it's preparing a report that the legislature by statute is supposed to get but never reads, doesn't really apply. Those are the things that we need to, or we will ask you to go back. And I, you know, we're all busy in our 8-hour work days doing, you know, pushing the paper around. But at some point, someone's got to be looking over the top and saying, you know, time out, what are we doing and why are we doing it? And I think the McKinsey report started that. But you can't always rely on someone from the outside to come parachute in and figure out how to do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, you're absolutely correct. And I would say two things about that. One of the things that McKinsey did for us was helped us institute a lean process. So even though they're no longer looking over our shoulder, they've given us some tools that we will continue this process with. But I also, despite I think what was a terrific improvement in our intake system, I don't mean to imply that with the tremendous caseload increases we've had and workload increases that those efficiencies are going to allow us to keep up with that. It's our caseloads are increasing exponentially in self-sufficiency, and what we're hoping is at least this helps us maintain as much service as we can. We have indeed begun the prioritization process. Some of the things that we were doing in case management in the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families programs are beginning to fall off the plate because there just aren't enough hours in a day to do those.
So this is a pretty simple bill. I would like to support this, and what I'd like to do is, again, bring the department back with maybe some online workers to give us a fuller picture of what the work is like. So we're not going to have a work session today, but if you have any problems with this.
Madam Chair, that is a great lead-in to my question.
I'm going to finish what I said first.
Yeah. I just wanted to know. That was a great lead-in. You're psychic.
Also. Oh, I am. I've got eyes in the back of my head, too. So, as I was saying, I would like to have further information from the department and from online workers so that we can get more information on this. But I really would like to pass this bill, and I would like to talk with you offline if you have any questions or concerns about this and how it can be improved.
Do you want us to come forward with those from our...
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Did you really have something to say?
I do, and it'll be quick.
Yes.
Just a quick question out of Jim. Do you do any pre-application stuff online for clients?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, actually one of the things that McKinsey recommended to us is try and expand our client access through online services, and we are currently in the testing phase for food stamps of an online application and hope to expand that to all of our application process. So, yes, indeed, that's exactly what we're looking at.
I kind of had a feeling that if you weren't there, that maybe you were headed there because of efficiencies. I would just encourage that you bring in, as you're working on, or who, IT, as they're working on the model for online access, to bring in a 19-year-old mother of two that barely graduated from high school and have them actually sit there and be able to fill out the form without having to call for assistance. I was listening to the Employment Department the other day talk about their online access to help speed up applications for unemployment, and it was either the same day or the next day, an intelligent woman from my district called in and said, I just got laid off and I tried to work through that, and I think I'm fairly smart, and I could not make it through without calling for assistance. So I think it's important to remember.
That's the same idea.
If I can fill it out, maybe I should come in, Jim, and help you. If I can fill it out, anybody can. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, we'd be delighted to have you come in and try out the online application and see.
As long as you don't report the results.
Hopefully you can do that on your in-service day. And if you can't, if you really can't go in your in-service day, we'll try to arrange sometime that the whole committee can go in, or maybe you can go in individually. Yes. Here in Salem, but I think it would be important to go in your own district to see what that is like.
Absolutely agree.
Good.
You better know who those people are.
Exactly, exactly. I just think that's really important. I think that's what in-service day, we're being paid for that day. I think it's important that we give the state their money's worth. Quick question.
Well, I just would like to say that in my productivity improvement project that I did run in Clackamas County, it was done by staff.
Yeah.
It was not a consultant who came in, except to train them how to do it. But the staff did it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, indeed, McKinsey outlined some opportunities for us, but it is absolutely about the people that are doing the work, helping design the best process to do that.
That's good.
Ways and Means, we heard about people, we were talking about being able to do this work in your eight-hour day. We heard about people hiding under their desks when the office closed at 5 o'clock, hiding in the restroom so they can get back and work. Yeah. Because they don't want to leave the work undone, and they're being discouraged from working overtime. So ask in your offices what that case is. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
The only time we have
I've
to work
them
is before 8 and
thing.
After 5, and because of the constant influx of people and requests.
If you made me leave at 5 o'clock, I'd be crazy.
Yeah.
Nope, because of the undone work.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not to blame the workers for not knowing how to change their processes. I mean, these are learned talents, learned skills on how to be able to evaluate what you're doing and look for improvements. Because it's not natural. It's natural to get into a into a steady state, and change is difficult for all of us.
It's a complex.
So we'll be anxious to see you again, Jim. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anybody else here who wants to speak on this bill? All right. We will close the.
2 weeks.
Why wait 2 weeks?
Well, we don't have to.
As soon as possible.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2123 and open up a public hearing on 2137.
This bill provides immunity from civil liability for individuals and agencies when protected information is disclosed in good faith and with reasonable grounds in connection with a protected proceeding. It allows the Department of Human Services to petition for a protective order and allows the department, the proposed public guardian or conservator, to disclose protected information if necessary for health and safety purposes.
Great. And so do we have somebody from the department who is wanting to speak on this? It looks like we do. Hi there. And we do have amendments. And colleagues, we also also have a letter from the LC, and I think it is signed by
Madam Chair, was that letter sent to us by email?
It was sent by email late in the day yesterday. Okay. I can provide hard copies as well.
I can get it when I get back
Dexter
to the office.
Johnson.
Oh, Dexter.
Okay. It has his name on it, but I think it was somebody
else. It's by someone else.
Yes.
It's by David Hendrick and Belisa Sidlick from Legislative Council.
Right. Thank you, Keeley. Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Oregon Department of Human Services. My office is responsible for the Adult Protective Service investigations and policy and procedures for seniors and people with physical disabilities. We coordinate very closely with the Office of Investigations and Training, which does the Adult Protective Services investigations for people with developmental disabilities and people who have disabilities related to mental health issues. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to testify on in support of House Bill 2137. This is a bill that was introduced at the request of the governor, it was requested by the department. There are three things that this bill does. The first is the current statute limits the department's ability to share information that we have gathered as a part of an adult protective services investigation with the probate court when a guardianship or a conservatorship has been filed. And so that's led us to situations where we may know that there is a guardianship or a conservatorship hearing happening, and we're not allowed under current law to go forward and share that information with the court. And so it leads to a situation where we may, at the local level, write a letter to the court indicating that we may have information, in which case the court will issue a court order for us to release that. That's certainly a process that we follow, the difficulty that we have with that is that it delays the sharing of information, sometimes in a situation where someone is in serious danger. Often these are situations where there's been withholding or neglect of providing basic needs like food and shelter. There's also situations of financial exploitation where all of someone's assets have been taken and used for something other than their benefit. The second thing that this bill does is it provides immunity to individuals who share information with the department or with a proposed guardian or conservator related to the vulnerability of an individual. This is a very difficult issue and one that we worked very hard with the Department of Justice on to craft language around. We heard some concerns from the Hospital Association, and so that led to the submission of the -2 amendments that you have in front of you to put some parameters on when the civil immunity would be given to individuals who shared information. The very difficult line that we walk is when there have been allegations and an investigation that show that an individual might be at risk or is at risk of serious harm, and that information is confidential. And so we want to be extremely careful about situations under which we would share that information, but also don't want to withhold information from the court that might be very valuable to them in making a decision in a particularly difficult situation. The last thing that this bill does is it expands the ability of Adult Protective Services to protect individuals by allowing the department to petition for protective proceeding. This doesn't happen very often, but they're very, very difficult situations when they do. On occasion, it's the case that there is an individual who is vulnerable, who is in an abusive situation, is being abused and neglected, and there is no one available to file for guardianship or conservatorship. And in those situations, on the advice of the Department of Justice, the department's hands have been tied. One particularly difficult situation was one of a young woman who had a traumatic brain injury, who was in a domestic violence situation. There was no one who was able to step in to file for protection of her. And so this violence continued for quite a period of time until we were able to come up with a plan to have someone step in, a court visitor actually to step in and help with that situation. And so if the department had had the authority to petition for some protection for her, because of her cognitive disability, she was unable to do safety planning and protect herself when the violence occurred. If we had been able to step in sooner, the violence could have been stopped much sooner than it had been already. I learned this morning that Mr. Joondef, who I believe wants to testify, has some legal concerns about this bill, and especially around the civil immunity, and as I say, that's a very difficult area that we want to address, and so would simply acknowledge Mr. Joondef's concerns and would welcome the opportunity to work with him to address his concerns in any amendments that we might be able to come up with. So as I say, this is a bill that we have asked for in response to some problems and concerns that we have, and appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mary. I know Bob Joondef has signed up to testify. Is anybody else here who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, I see other people in the audience, and I just wondered if you had interest in testifying, but it looks like nobody's putting up their hand. Okay.
I just have a question. Boone. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mary, you said if you had been able to advocate for the patient, you would have sooner. So I just to get this clear, I'm not sure how the department came to be aware of the abuse of this person. But at that point, I would imagine you would report it, and then something would happen. And that's kind of my question, is then from that point on, wouldn't there be some sort of action to rectify that situation?
Chair Tomei and Representative Boone, thank you for the opportunity to clarify. In that situation, it's entirely likely that an Adult Protective Services report would have been made by, say, a neighbor or, you know, someone who had occasion to observe the violence or saw this woman who, you know, was bruised and battered and such. So when that gets called into the local office, absolutely we respond and we investigate. And what we found in this situation was a woman who had cognitive impairments because of a traumatic brain injury, who was not able to access domestic violence services and implement a safety plan to protect herself when the violence occurred. And so one of the possible routes would have been to look for friends, support, family that might be able to help her protect herself. There wasn't anyone. And in all honesty, part of the domestic violence cycle is isolation of the victim. And so in that situation, another avenue would have been for the department to go to court and say, we're very concerned about this young woman who seems unable to protect herself, who is a vulnerable adult, and who is in the situation where she is being abused. Because the department doesn't have the legal authority to go to court with that kind of a plea, we were unable to intervene as quickly as we might have been able to, and took a different route that took a much longer period of time.
Just a quick follow-up, just so I can get this straight, and I know maybe it's different than in child abuse, but I would think if whatever avenue came to you, the report of the abuse, it would also go to the law enforcement, and the person who did the abuse would be removed, or the person who was abused would be removed and put somewhere else. That it just seems odd to say that because this wasn't in place, there was no avenue to handle this, and so she suffered further abuse. I guess I'm not getting that part.
Chair Tomei and Representative Boone, we work very closely with law enforcement at the local level, and in this case did make a referral to law enforcement. There were no reports filed of domestic violence, and this was a victim who was not very able to report what had happened to her. And so even though law enforcement wanted to intervene, in this particular case, they didn't have the legal grounds to get a search warrant to enter the home to remove the victim or the perpetrator. This was a very difficult situation, and the local office worked very hard with local law enforcement and with the Adult Protective Services policy consultants in my office, and just hit roadblocks every road we went down. And so those are the kinds of problems that we identify and look to rectify with this kind of request.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I would hope someone would step up and intervene, and, if they feel like they're putting themselves in violation of the law, sometimes there's civil disobedience in order to save a life is probably an appropriate reaction. And I, in fact, did something happen? Did we protect this person?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, we did protect this person. My understanding is what we were able to do was to ask the court for a court visitor to volunteer, essentially, to go in this home and do some reporting back to the court and went about it that way. But as I say, we tried lots of different legal avenues in order to get to that position. In terms of the civil disobedience, the position that the local APS worker was in was he or she had a lot of confidential private information that is protected by law. And for the worker to have disclosed that without legal authority would have put them at risk for violation of the law, lawsuit.
And that's my point. I mean, in my career in the military, I stepped that line several times to protect people. And at the end of the day, people shake your hand and say thank you, and then you go back and revisit the law like we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not advocating law breaking in that regard, but life and limb, most people are pretty forgiving. But a follow-up to that, and I'm waiting for Bob to come forward. HIPAA is a federal law, and so my question is, how does this join up with the federal law, which is pretty specific, but I know the states can make it more restrictive. How does this fit together?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, it's exactly because of those concerns, the dovetailing with not only the federal HIPAA law but the Oregon privacy laws, that we worked with the Department of Justice to craft language, not only for the original request for the bill but for the -2 amendments around that. And so, as I say, Mr. Joondef, I know, has further concerns about the civil immunity and the release of protected information, and so we would proceed forward with getting together our Department of Justice, Assistant Attorney General, and Mr. Joondef to address those concerns.
And did you get this information, I guess, from Bill Taylor? Apparently, had first asked for it on February 16th of this year.
No.
Several
pages.
Do you
want me to go make copies of that?
We're going to hear this again so people can make sure that you have it. If you can make sure that
it was emailed yesterday.
Right, okay.
We'll pull it up.
Right. And did you already address the -2 amendments, how that changes the original bill?
Chair Tomei, I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit more. The -2 amendments were simply some language clarification. They primarily were around putting some limits on the civil immunity so that someone who shared confidential information would be immune only if it was I'd have to look at the particular language, but if there's a situation of serious harm or imminent danger, those kinds of things. So the release of confidential information wouldn't be okay in a situation where the person wasn't immediately in danger.
Great. And I know you don't have it here, and if you feel like it's important, I can ask Keeley to make copies of it. It's like 6 or 7 pages. But at the end, One of the concerns from LC was that it may create a new basis for liability, and they suggest that there be an amendment, and I'm not sure this is in the dash two. The provisions of this act do not create a cause of action and may not be asserted as a basis for a per se negligence claim. And I'm sure you've seen this, right?
Chair Tomei, actually I haven't. We have asked our Department of Justice attorney to be in touch with Ledge Counsel, and that's what happened with the dash twos. But I'll certainly follow up and make sure that we address those concerns as well.
I think I sent that over to Karen Mainzer yesterday as well.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Just hasn't made its way to me yet.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else before we get Bob June Deaf up here? All right. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
Bob. Good to see you.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of the Disability Rights Oregon. And I'd like to just start out by saying that we applaud the intention of this bill. Protecting vulnerable people is what our organization is about, and we have worked very closely with the Department of Human Services in general on this topic, and actually very specifically on the very matters that were brought to you today. We've been brought in situations in which there have been individuals, vulnerable individuals in homes that were outside the scope of protective services action, and we've actually filed guardianship petitions in situations in which they were necessary in order to seek protection for very vulnerable people. And so my criticisms of this bill, I do not make lightly, but I think that they're quite important to point out to you. One thing to understand, I think, about the guardianship process is that it is a civil law process that allows a court to take away virtually all of an adult's rights to control their own lives. It takes away the person's right to decide where they want to live, how to use their money, medical decision-making is taken away. It's given to somebody else. It's very profound. And so it shouldn't. And I know that the Department of Human Services, and we don't take it lightly, it has two phases involved in it normally. One is a temporary guardianship proceeding in which an allegation can be made to a court that there's a very serious problem, that it's affecting a person's life and safety, and the court has the authority, without a hearing, to move ahead and create a temporary situation in which a person can be appointed as a guardian to intervene for a period of weeks while the lengthier guardianship proceeding is put into place, so that then all the evidence can be gathered in and then there can be a full guardianship process. And it is through that full process that a person can be appointed a guardian. And once a guardian is appointed, that guardian will remain in place until such time as the court removes it, which can be for the rest of the person's life. So this is a very significant procedure. It affects very profound set of rights, and it can go on forever. So that's why we look very carefully at any provision that's going to affect how that works. Which brings us to the provisions of 2137. First of all, we are of the opinion that the portion of the bill that gives some protection for people for making referrals to a public guardian or to the Department of Human Services is a good thing. We think that people should be encouraged to report situations in which they're very concerned about the safety of a person with disabilities, a vulnerable person, and that should be encouraged. And, of course, under our protective service laws, there's mandatory reporting requirements for a whole variety of people. But we also feel that everyday citizens should feel encouraged to report situations that they believe are serious. However, the bill goes further than that and goes to what are protected health, mental health, financial and legal information, and these are all, of course, protected by information that are protected by law in a variety of different ways. We have health and mental health information, that are protected by certain laws, financial information by others, and, of course, legal information by yet others. And yet the way the bill is written right now, it would provide complete immunity for any individual who, in their own mind, in good faith, believes that a person's in imminent risk to release all mental health information, all health information, all legal information, all financial information to either Department of Human Services or a public guardian organization. And what, and on top of that, what the bill does not make any limitations on what portion of that information could be revealed. Now, under the HIPAA law that Representative Maurer was referring to earlier, they do have a provision that deals expressly with protective services types of complaints. And the HIPAA law limits the information, this type of protected information that can be revealed, to things that are essentially directly relevant to the matter at hand, directly relevant to the danger at hand. Whereas, as at least I read this bill, it's just completely open book. A person can reveal any of this protected information, and at least within the bounds of this bill, there's no prohibition against re-release by whoever receives it. Now, there may be other provisions in DHS, or DHS may perceive itself as protecting this information from re-release, but at least within this bill, there is no protection from a public guardian then turning around and whatever information it is, moving that information out to a third party, which is a matter of concern, of course. Now, presently, as I understand it, Department of Human Services, and I believe the earlier testimony said, Department of Human Services can use this information in a court proceeding, but it must get permission from the court beforehand. So there is a check and balance in there. It's not that that information can't move to a court. It's that a step has to be taken initially in order for it to be used. And at least in our experience in working in this area, we don't believe that that has created a great impediment to protective proceedings going forward. As I noted earlier, there is a two-stage process in protective services, one being the emergency guardianship process and the second being the lengthier and more comprehensive full guardianship process. The way the law is written in that initial phase, which is the phase I think that's important for making an intervention to protect a person who's seriously at risk of harm, without that intervention, the court will appoint a visitor whose job it is to go out and to investigate the situation and report back to the court. The courts refer to this as having someone who's their eyes and ears to go out and find out what's going on so that the court can have the information to make a decision. And this is a point at which having relevant information be able to get to that court visitor is important. There's a distinction between having that information come to the visitor and having that introduced into court. And yet, but right now, if DHS needs to have authorization to release information for that purpose, we believe that they can get it from a court. But if there are genuine problems in terms of that happening, having a finely tailored provision that says that only relevant information can be released and that information remains confidential beyond that point of release, I think that that would be much more finely tailored to address the problem that DHS is pointing out. And finally, there is a provision in here about releasing information to the court. And again, normally, as we understand it, the court will make a decision about that when DHS or another party comes forward with information. Once the court orders information to be released, that absolves any party from any liability for that release, because the court is saying, "I want you to do it," and that's a defense to any claim that confidentiality has been breached. All of this is to say that we have concerns about some of the, not about the intent, not about the purpose of the bill, and many of the provisions of the bill we think are positive, but we think that it just goes too far and it's too broad, and we'd like to work with the Department of Human Services to try to narrow it down to achieve its purpose without opening the door to a broad release of people's very protected information.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions of Mr. Joondiff? Representative Maurer.
No, and Bob, I appreciate this. I mean, in the medical world, you know, life and limb is usually where we deal with these release issues, but the financial is not, where DHS, in this situation, that may be where it's really relevant. And so I hope we take these amendments, changes to heart and work, because I think it is necessary to create a better process.
Great. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things, as you were describing this, I couldn't help but reflect that there's so much of it that seems quite familiar with juvenile court process. So am I incorrect in my assumption that there are similarities between this and what we do in juvenile court?
Representative Tomei, Representative Van Orman, juvenile court has a variety of purposes, and I don't practice in juvenile court. And but some of it is related to criminal behavior and some dependency behavior. So in terms of the dependency part, there may be some similarities between court actions that are designed to protect people from harm, either a child from harm or, in this case, an adult from harm. One of the differences, of course, is that in the guardianship area, we are talking about adults, mm-hmm. and adults who unless there's some court finding otherwise, have the full array of adult rights that we all appreciate. And so rather than addressing, say, who should be the responsible party for someone else, we have to decide that threshold question about whether we're going to step in and take away rights that a person would have for themselves and be able to go forward and exercise for themselves. And that's a very critical point in time. While I think that both proceedings are looking at the best interest of the person, making that threshold question about whether a person can control themselves is very profound, and that's what occurs in the guardianship court.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, I just want to thank you for what you do and your group. In my family, we're experiencing a personal situation that this has been very helpful to me to hear you say these very things as we consider what's going to be the future now. Thank you.
Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Bob, I really appreciate your concern that this information be used effectively and narrowly in a focused way. And I'm just wondering about what you see as what you believe is the proper shelf life for this information, you know, once it has been delivered either by an individual to DHS or to the court, then when does it go away, as it were, or does it suffer perhaps the fate of eternal life?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, that's an excellent question, I don't think that there's a definitive answer to that, which is one of the reasons that we feel more comfortable when a court or an objective decision maker is making the call about whether information is going to come into a public record or not come into a public record. Once something is introduced into a court proceeding, of course, it's now in a file, and unless specifically sealed by a court, it's a matter of public record. I think it's important for some arbitrator, a judge in this case, to make a decision about whether information is relevant to the situation, and thus our anxiety about the way the bill's written now.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, I was trying to follow you, and I heard you say a few different things. You kind of recounted a number of steps that in the legal process that can be taken now to protect these individuals. So I almost thought you were heading to an area of saying there are protections and procedures in place, so this is not necessary. But then, toward the end of your testimony, you said, but there are some good points about this that just need to be fine-tuned, and you'd be willing to work on that. So do you feel there is a problem out there that needs tightening up and fixing?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, good catch. What I'd say is that probably one of the reasons that I'm up here is that I'm approaching this area from a different perspective. So my perspective is coming from that of the individuals who are affected, because those are the people we normally represent, whereas the Department of Human Services is coming at it from the purpose of trying to follow through with their protective services activities. I don't do their work, and so what I would like to have an opportunity to do is to sit down with them to understand better what impediments they are actually confronting. Because from my perspective, I don't see those impediments. And from my own experience, if we were just relying upon my experience, I would say, yes, there are appropriate protections in place, and we don't need additional ones. But I'm very open to hearing from the Department of Human Services about their experience to see if in fact there are, and if there are ways that we can narrowly address them. So thus my speaking from two directions.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Follow-up?
Just to follow up on the once the court does approve or appoint a guardianship situation, does the guardianship have to submit a plan to the court, and or how rigid is the decision-making process for the individual that doesn't have the capability to make the decisions for themselves? How fine-tuned is the process with the court in making decisions? Does the guardian, do they have the ability to make a lot of decisions without going to the judge and saying, I want to do this? Or does the judge put some sideboards on the guardianship? How does that work?
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, there's generally two areas that we're talking about. One is a guardianship and one is a conservatorship. And I'll make this overly simple.
Thank you.
is that a person who's been appointed guardian has the right to make decisions for the other person in some very definite areas. One, where the person lives, their health care decision-making, and how they use, how some small amounts of money are used. And there's a few other minor things, but those are the major health care decisions, if I haven't mentioned those. The guardian's responsibility is to exercise that authority and to report to the court on an annual basis, so an annual filing with the court about what they've done that year. So the judge is not going to normally intervene in second-guess decisions a guardian has made or make direct decisions, although under our law, a judge does have the authority to actually make decisions for the person themselves in limited circumstances. In a conservatorship, there's many more details in terms of how a person can use another person's money, and there are requirements in terms of coming back to the court in certain instances to get approval for how to use that money. So there are more circumstances in which prior approval is necessary. But in a guardianship area, there pretty much isn't prior approval. The guardian goes forth, is supposed to act in the best interest of the individual, and reports on a yearly basis. And as a practical matter, a matter will only come back to the court if someone objects to the way that the guardian has been acting.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bob. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this? Seeing no one offer. I'd really be very interested in following up on this, so I hope that you will meet together, and if you need to meet with legislative council, I hope you do that, that you can craft something that everybody can live with, but also that will protect vulnerable folks. So thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2137. And I just want to remind folks, we will be meeting at 8:30 on Monday, and this is the change in daylight savings time. So it will feel like 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, sweet spring.
It always feels like 7:30 in the morning.
So remember to set your clock back. Right.
All my employees seem to.
Slumber party this week.
You are. That or close the... Okay, you guys.
They're out of control.
Out of control. Closing the House Committee.